From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The new way that governments are using surveillance since 9/11. This is mass surveillance. It's more pervasive than ever, and it has becoming globalized. And most Americans have no idea what's going on.
Illusions of security. Human rights lawyer Maureen Webb on global surveillance and democracy in the post 9/11 world. Then we continue with our coverage of Ultra Funds.
Mr. Sheehan says it wasn't a bribe. They were only trying to help the Zambian people.
We offered to donate debt to a low-income housing initiative, which was a charitable initiative, which did end up building over several thousand houses for the poor. You're contorting the facts. You're on my property, and I would ask you to step off.
Pressure is coming from Congress and the grassroots to prevent Western companies from buying up developing countries' debts, then forcing them to pay off the debt at a far higher price. But first, Iraqi blogger Raed Jarar has obtained and translated a copy of a new oil law being considered in Iraq. We'll take a look at what it means for the future of the third largest oil reserves in the world. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The BBC's reporting the U.S. military has drawn up contingency plans for massive airstrikes against Iran. The plan calls for attacks on Iran's nuclear sites, air bases, naval bases, missile facilities, and command and control centers. As part of the plan, long-range B-2 stealth bombers would drop so-called bunker-busting bombs to penetrate Iran's underground uranium enrichment plant at Natanz. The BBC's report comes at a time of heightened tension between the United States and Iran. Earlier today, the U.S. aircraft carrier USS Stennis arrived in Middle Eastern waters. The U.S. will soon have two aircraft carriers in the Persian Gulf for the first time since the start of the Iraq War. Defense Secretary Robert Gates has admitted the Stennis was deployed to the Gulf to send a message to Iran. Meanwhile, Iran has announced it will not agree to suspend uranium enrichment by tomorrow's deadline, as demanded by the U.N. Security Council. In Iraq, the Pentagon has announced the deaths of nine more U.S. service members. This brings the U.S. death toll in Iraq to 3,144. At least two soldiers died when assailants raided a U.S. military outpost in Tarmia, in what's been described as one of the biggest assaults in months on a U.S. military base. Suicide bombers began the attack by driving cars laden with explosives into the base. Gunmen then opened fire. In Baghdad, two members of the Shia-led police force have been accused of raping a Sunni woman during the massive security crackdown in the capital. The woman appeared on Al Jazeera Monday, said she was raped after being detained over the weekend. Soon after the report aired, Iraqi Prime Minister Nour al-Maliki promised a full investigation. But 4 hours later, he dismissed the rape allegations and commended the police officers. He accused the woman of spreading propaganda to undermine the security forces. Sunni leaders accused the Shia-led government of covering up the rape. One Sunni group said, quote, "This is evidence of the failure of the security plan, which was supposed to secure our women before our men." Analysts in the Middle East say Monday's peace talks in Jerusalem have accomplished little. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice met with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Rice briefly spoke to reporters after the summit.
The President and the Prime Minister discussed their views of the diplomatic and political horizon and how it might unfold toward the two-state vision of President Bush. The President and Prime Minister agreed that they would meet together again soon. They reiterated their desire for American participation and leadership in facilitating efforts to overcome obstacles, rally regional and international support, and move forward toward peace. In that vein, I expect to return to the region soon.
Israel's Prime Minister Ehud Olmert publicly rejected the new Palestinian coalition government.
We will not recognize any government that does not carry out these obligations, and we will not cooperate with it or any of its ministers. I decided we have to maintain a channel of communications with the Palestinians, and the sole possible channel is the president of the Palestinian Authority, who was elected directly by the public.
Hamas spokesperson Fawzi Barhoon criticized the stance of Israel and the United States.
They are dealing negatively with this situation and force all of their pressure against Abbas in order to break this unity and this solidarity with all Palestinian parties and with all Palestinians be able toward this political situation to form this unity government.
In news from Capitol Hill, Congress is coming under criticism for approving a little notice provision last year that makes it easier for President Bush to declare martial law and to send U.S. troops into American cities. At the administration's request, Congress approved the changes to a law known as the Insurrection Act without ever holding a public hearing. Under the new law, the president now has the authority to use both active duty armed forces and the Guard on American soil, not just during a rebellion, but also a natural disaster, terrorist attack, pandemic, or other chaotic situation. All 50 of the nation's governors have opposed the rule changes. Earlier this month, Senators Patrick Leahy, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Republican Christopher Bond introduced legislation to repeal the changes Congress approved last year. Vice President Dick Cheney has arrived in Japan on the first stop of a trip that will also take him to Australia. U.S. officials have said Cheney is expected to urge both countries to send more troops to Iraq and Afghanistan. Cheney is scheduled to meet with Japan's emperor and prime minister. But one official Cheney won't be meeting with is Japan's foreign minister, Fumio Kishida. He recently said the U.S. invasion of Iraq was a mistake. Cheney's visit to Japan comes a week after two small bombs exploded outside the U.S. military base, Camp Zuma, south of Tokyo. No one was injured in the blasts. A group called the Revolutionary Army claimed responsibility, saying it was meant to disrupt the vice president's visit and to protest the presence of U.S. troops in Japan. The United States has about 50,000 troops based in Japan. On Saturday, Cheney will meet with Australia's Prime Minister John Howard, who's expected to urge Cheney to expedite the trial of Australian citizen David Hicks being held at Guantanamo. Colombia's foreign minister, Maria Consuelo Araujo, has resigned just days after her brother was arrested for alleged ties to illegal right-wing paramilitary groups involved in cocaine trafficking. Last week, Colombia's Supreme Court ordered her brother, Senator Alvaro Araujo, and five other lawmakers to be arrested for ties to paramilitary groups. All the arrested lawmakers are supporters of Colombian President Alvaro Uribe. Maria Consuelo Araujo announced her resignation as foreign minister on Monday.
Me voy porque no estoy
I'm leaving because I am not tied to any charge. I see clearly that the judicial process must be free of any interference.
Que el proceso judicial esté libre de interferencias. La certeza de la inocencia
the certainty of my father's and my brother's innocence obligates me to leave in order to have the freedom to be at their side, to support them as a daughter and a sister. I appreciate your support, Mr. President.
Colombian President Uribe has named Fernando Araujo Perdomo as the country's new foreign minister. Araujo Perdomo spent almost all the last 6 years held hostage by FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. He escaped in December. In media news, the nation's two satellite radio networks plan to merge. On Monday, Sirius Satellite Radio announced plans to buy its rival XM for $4.6 billion in stock. The merger will require the approval of the Federal Communications Commission. Jeff Chester of the Center for Digital Democracy criticized the proposed deal. He said, quote, such a merger would mean a reduction in the quantity and quality of programming available to the public. In other media news, two of the world's largest record companies could also soon merge. The U.S.-based Warner Music has approached the British company EMI over a possible deal. In Washington, jurors will hear closing arguments today in the trial of Louis Scooter Libby, Vice President Dick Cheney's former chief of staff. Both sides will be given 3 hours to make their final arguments. And Monday marked the 65th anniversary of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's signing of Executive Order 9066. The order forced 120,000 Japanese-American citizens and legal residents into internment camps during World War II solely because they were of Japanese descent. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In one of the first studies of Iraqi public opinion after the U.S.-led invasion of March 2003, the polling firm Gallup asked Iraqis their thoughts on the Bush administration's motives for going to war. 1% of Iraqis said they believed the motive was to establish democracy. Slightly more, 5%, said to assist the Iraqi people. But far in the lead was the answer they got. 43%, quote, to rob Iraq's oil. Well, with the four-year mark of the Iraq war less than a month away, the answer may come into clearer view. After a long negotiation process involving U.S. officials, the Iraqi government is considering a new oil law that would establish a framework for managing the third-largest oil reserves in the world. What would this new law mean for Iraq? Well, with me now in Washington is Ed Girar. He is the Iraq Project Director for Global Exchange, and he's obtained a copy of the proposed oil law, which he translated from Arabic and posted on his website, raedinthemiddle.blogspot.com. Antonia Juhas is also with us on the telephone. She's written extensively about the economic side of the U.S. occupation of Iraq and is author of the book The Bush Agenda, Invading the World One Economy at a Time. Antonia is currently a Tarbell Fellow at Oil Change International. We welcome you both to Democracy Now. Ed Girar, first, how did you get this document?
The document was leaked by Professor Fuad Al-Amir and published on a website called Al-Ghad, al-ghad.org. And then it was leaked to other important websites like niqash.org and other places. There are different ways of different copies of it. Some of it are scanned and others are the original document. But it just hit the internet last week.
And explain what it says now that you've finished translating it.
It said so many things. I don't think we can summarize it this short because it's a very long document, around 30 pages. But majorly, there are three major points that I think we should talk about. Financially, it legalizes very unfair types of contracts that will put Iraq in very long-term contracts that can go up to 35 years and cause the loss of hundreds of billions of dollars from Iraqis for no cause. And the second point is concerning Iraq's sovereignty. Iraq will not be capable of controlling the levels, the limits of production, which means that Iraq cannot be a part of OPEC anymore. And Iraq will have this very complicated institution called the Federal Oil and Gas Council that will have representatives from the foreign oil companies on the board of it. So representatives from, let's say, ExxonMobil and Shell and British Petroleum will be on the federal board of Iraq approving their own contracts. And the third point is the point about keeping Iraq's unity. The law is seen by many Iraqi analysts as a separation for Iraq fund. The law will authorize all of the regional and small provinces authorities. It will give them the final say to deal with the oil instead of giving this final say to the central federal government. So it will open the doors for splitting Iraq into three regions or even maybe three states in the very near future.
Antonia Juhas, what is the significance of this for Western oil companies?
Well, in my mind, the law certainly opens the door to U.S. oil companies and the Bush administration winning a very large piece of their objective of going to war in Iraq, at least winning it on paper. The law does almost word for word what was laid out in the Baker-Hamilton recommendations, which I discussed previously on your show, which is, at the very basic level, to turn Iraq's nationalized oil system, the model that 90% of the world's oil is governed by, take its nationalized oil system and turn it into a commercial system fully open to foreign corporate investment on terms as of yet to be decided. So it leaves vague this very important question of what type of contracts will the Iraqi government use. But what it leaves clear is that basically every level of the oil industry will be opened to private foreign companies. And as Raed said, it introduces this very unique model, which is that ultimate decision-making on contracts rests with a new council to be set up in Iraq. And sitting on that council will be representatives, executives, in fact, of oil companies, both foreign and domestic. In addition, it does maintain the Iraq National Oil Company, but gives the Iraq National Oil Company almost no preference. It's almost in all cases just another oil company among lots of other companies, including U.S. oil companies. And this council, the new Oil and Gas Council, is going to be the decision-making body to determine what kind of contract the Iraqis can sign, and all contract models are still on the table, yet to be determined. I think that's left vague or open so that the very necessary criticism to earlier drafts of the law, which included specifically production sharing agreements, might be quieted. But the law definitely sets up a very dangerous setup for Iraq's future economic stability, economic development, and certainly sets the stage for a tremendous amount of increased hostility and violence to U.S. soldiers positioned on the ground as being seen as the implementers of this oil hijack.
Antonio, what about the advocates' argument for Western company involvement that they need to come into Iraq to kickstart the oil development?
Iraq's oil development has actually been going quite well since the invasion under the guidance of the Iraqis themselves. Prior to the war, Iraq produced 2.5 million barrels of oil a day. Since the war, it's been producing about 2.2 million barrels of oil a day. That's definitely dropped most recently because of the intense violence in Iraq of late. And there has definitely been targeted actions against the oil system. As demonstrations of opposition to the occupation. So I believe there is a very concrete argument that can be made that the best thing that Iraq can do right now to see its oil infrastructure secure and pumping at a reasonable level is to see the U.S. occupation end. Given that Iraq's oil only costs less than a dollar per barrel to pump, and oil is selling at over $50 per barrel, the Iraqis are already making a tremendous return on their oil. The danger is that under the different models of oil contract that are being put on the table, that the Iraqis would lose the vast majority of that profit to the foreign oil companies. Now, just really quickly, Iraqis have lost a fair amount of expertise, technical know-how, as technology has increased over the past 11 years, and the Iraqis were shut out because of the sanctions. The answer to that is found in the models put forward by their neighbors, Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and Iran, which are technical service contracts that countries sign with foreign companies to bring in that expertise, but under very limited time frames and very specific economic benefits to the companies and to the country, not these 35-year contracts, as Riad said, and the potential for vast profits leaving the country.
Riad Giarrar, what is the response of Iraqis, of people in Iraq?
No one in Iraq knows about the law. The law has been kept in a very low profile, and there is a huge propaganda campaign by the government trying to portray the law as great and good for Iraq, and good for a law that will turn Iraq into heaven on earth because it will bring all of the foreign investments. Even parliamentarians in the Iraqi government, the ones who will have the final say to pass this law, haven't received a copy of this law yet. I sent them the copy 3 or 4 days ago. And I sent the copy to many of the other Iraqi bloggers and journalists because I think it's very important to raise awareness about this and make it an issue. The Iraqi government and the Bush administration are trying to keep a very low profile in Iraq about on this law. I think they are planning just to, surprise the parliamentarians one morning and have them vote on it without any knowledge of what the law actually causes.
Can you talk, Riad Giarrar, about the control, the dispute over federal or regional control of oil in Iraq?
Most of the control will be under the regional and provincial authorities. They have the all of the authority of monitoring and even dealing with small disputes. Now, there is this bigger council that is very complicated, very bureaucratic. This council just has the authority to veto what the regional and provincial authorities decide. So in case the council just stayed silent, everything can go without any interruption. So you can see that this council is kind of controlled by foreign companies as well. So the possibilities of the council vetoing what's happening on the regional level will be very small. So we end up having a situation where Iraqis in different provinces will start signing contracts directly with foreign companies and competing between themselves, among themselves, among different Iraqi provinces to get the oil companies to go to there without any centralized way in controlling this and thinking of the Iraqi interest and protecting Iraq as a country.
Iraq, this document that you've translated into English was originally written in Arabic?
No. Now, the document was originally written in English. It was sent to the Iraqi Oil Ministry, and some parts of it were changed, and some parts were edited, some parts were added. So when I translated it, I made my translation based on a previously leaked English copy, which is the original version of this law. The English copy leaked in mid-2006. So this the Arabic version now is totally based on that one. There are, I think, out of the 29 or 30 pages, there are around 6 or 7 totally new pages, and there are new sections here and there. But the major differences, as I mentioned, are regarding the authorities that can control oil, and it can show very clearly what the Iraqi leaders who are influential and can control these laws are planning to do. It can show very clearly that there are very influential separatist Iraqi leaders who are trying to use this law to fund their separatist project into turning Iraq into 3 states. So, you can, in fact, one of the things that I did while translating is I kept some traces of the original one and put a line over the, like, stroke them, so that people can see the small differences, how many of the authorities that were supposed to be given to the central government and to the ministry were shifted to the regional authorities. Like, this is the most interesting thing that happened in the changes. But overall, it's a law that is promoted by the Bush administration and the IMF. It's not at all an urgent item on the Iraqi agenda, it's just an urgent item on the Bush and the IMF agenda.
Finally, Antonia, who has the largest oil reserves in the world, the top three?
Saudi Arabia is one, Iraq is two, Iran is three. And I think in that list, particularly obviously Iraq and Iran, you can see pretty clearly a key focus for the Bush administration in its remaining years in office.
Do you think that is related to this current intensification of focus on Iran, the possibility of a U.S. strike on Iran?
Oh, most certainly. You know, to be clear, oil is about a lot of things. Oil is about profit, and it's about the money that the oil interests in the United States, which of course also include members of the Bush administration, can get. But controlling the second and third largest oil reserves in the world also has a tremendous amount to do with imperial power and global power that the Bush administration wants. Controlling that oil denies it to other countries that want it, like China and India, countries that the Bush administration now sees itself in rivalry to. And it also gets the government in control of a resource that is obviously dwindling in supply and which they want to hold on to. And they have been quite clear, meaning members of the Bush administration, but also the United States government, in its dedication to securing Middle East oil for the United States. And that agenda has hit high speed under this administration, where, you know, corporate and oil interests are part and parcel to government interests. And I definitely think that if we in the United States want to end the war in Iraq and want to prevent another war in Iran, we have to pull back this curtain over that three-letter word, oil, and expose this agenda. The four-year anniversary of the war coming up March 19th is a critically important opportunity to do that, and in the lead-up to that anniversary, to really target our attention on demanding that our members of Congress defund the war, and that we direct our attention and our protest energy on revealing this oil agenda. And to that end, Oil Change International, the organization I work with, is going to be in the coming weeks working with our allies to pull together some clear lists of activities and actions that folks can do, particularly on exposing the oil law in Iraq. So I encourage folks to come to our website to check that out.
Antonia Yuhas, I want to thank you for being with us. Tor Bell Fellow at the Oil Change International, author of The Bush Agenda, Invading the World One Economy at a Time, and Raed Jarar in Washington, D.C., is the Iraq Project Director for Global Exchange. His blog is raedinthemiddle.blogspot.com. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute.
Voices on the radio tell us that we're going to war. Those brave men and women in uniform, they want to know what they're fighting for. The generals want to hear the end game. The allies want to prove the plan.
Billy Bragg, The Price of Oil, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to our continuing coverage of vulture funds. Vulture funds are Western companies profiting off buying up countries' debts and then forcing those countries to pay off the debt at a far higher price. Last week on BBC, investigative journalist Greg Palast exposed the attempts of one company trying to collect $40 million from the government of Zambia after buying one of its debts for $4 million. Zambia claims the company, Debt Advisory International, even tried to bribe government officials by offering to make a donation to, quote, the president's favorite charity. Palast questioned the company's owner, Michael Francis Sheehan, about the allegation. We ran it on Democracy Now!
Mr. Sheehan says it wasn't a bribe. They were only trying to help the Zambian people.
We offered to donate debt to a low-income housing initiative, which was a charitable initiative, which did end up building over several thousand houses for the poor. You're contorting the facts. You're on my property, and I would ask you to step off.
We showed this to the current president's advisor.
he was not impressed.
When you are talking about any amount, $40 million or thereabout, to be paid to service some unfair debt, you are talking about in excess of 300,000 children being prevented from going to school.
An excerpt of the BBC Newsnight report from investigative journalist Greg Palast that we went on Democracy Now! Last Thursday. Hours after we aired the story, a British court ruled on the case. Zambia was ordered to pay Sheehan's company $20 million on its original $4 million debt. The Zambian government says the money will have to come directly from its budget for health and education. Well, an international campaign is emerging to prevent Debt Advisory International from collecting. One day after the ruling, House Judiciary Chair John Conyers appeared on Democracy Now! The Michigan Congress member said he raised the issue with President Bush on Thursday after hearing Palast's report on our broadcast.
But it was my job, I felt, to raise the whole question of this bond speculation that goes on at the expense of poor debtor countries in which their debt is bought up and then they're sued for the full amount. It's bought up at pennies on the dollar, and then they're sued. And I wanted to thank you for revealing this to us, because it allowed me to ask President Bush two questions, one about Paul Singer and Michael Sheehan, and two, whether he would be willing to stop this incredible misuse of our government's charity toward funding aid to our poor nations.
Democratic Congressmember John Conyers. Paul Singer, by the way, is one of the chief Republican fundraisers in this country for both, well, presidential hopeful Rudolph Giuliani as well as President Bush. In addition to Congress, pressure is also coming from the grassroots. The Debt Relief and Economic Justice Group, Jubilee USA, is launching a new effort today, calling on Debt Advisory International to drop its efforts to collect the money from the Zambian government. For more, we go back to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Jubilee USA Director Kirsten Sandell. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Kirsten.
Thank you, Amy. It's good to be with you.
Can you talk about what you're doing with this information?
Yes. Well, today we are calling on people in the United States to call Debt Advisory International, to call their Washington, D.C. office at 202-463-2188. And to tell Michael Sheehan, who is the owner of Debt Advisory International and Donegal International, not to take $20 million of the money that was freed up by debt cancellation for the people of Zambia.
Kirsten, what effect does this have on Zambia? Why are you so concerned about this?
Well, the money that was freed up through debt cancellation for the people of Zambia was the result of 10 years of campaigning by people in the Global South, in the Global North, working together for debt cancellation. And I recently returned from Zambia, where I was a member of a delegation from Jubilee USA, to see some of the impacts of debt cancellation there. And we visited hospitals where user fees have just recently been abolished with the proceeds from debt cancellation. We were told about plans to hire thousands of additional teachers with money freed by debt cancellation. And if Michael Sheehan collects $20 million, that will take fully half of the money that was freed up this year by debt cancellation and would certainly prevent the Zambian government from implementing these plans.
How exactly does it happen? How does a Western, a U.S. company, get their hands on this debt? And a British court rules on their behalf.
Well, this dates back to 1999, when Donegal International, a vulture fund, bought up a portion of Zambia's debt at the bargain basement price of $3.3 million. And then has been holding on to this. And now that Zambia is eligible for debt cancellation under a deal that was reached at the G8 in 2005, it's now trying to collect this money. And it originally was trying to collect up to $55 million. The judge ruled that it could collect a maximum of $20 million, and we'll find out on March 9th exactly how much that they are able to collect from the government of Zambia.
How typical is this?
Well, this is something that is just coming to the attention of Jubilee USA and debt campaigners here in the United States. I know that this is also something that's happened in Peru. It's something that's happened in the Congo as well. And so we're very concerned, and people around the world who've been working on this issue for the last 10 years are very concerned, because the money freed up from debt cancellation is meant to address extreme poverty in the countries, not to go line the pockets of people who are taking advantage, like the vulture funds, and buying up debt and then trying to collect on it later.
Are you coordinating with the House Judiciary Chair, John Conyers, who says he's calling for an investigation?
We are also communicating with the Office of Representative Conyers, and we're going to be investigating, also exploring with him what further can be done preemptively, in addition to the efforts that are going on today to put pressure on Michael Sheehan. And I should also say, if people want to fax or email his office today, they can also do that via the Jubilee USA website, which is jubileeusa.org, beginning at 9 a.m. Eastern this morning.
Kristen Sundell, I want to thank you for being with us, Outreach Coordinator for Jubilee USA Network.
Thanks, Amy.
Thank you for joining us from Washington, D.C. As we turn now to our final story of the day. Love letters, bank transactions, library books, scuba diving lessons. Can the government actually use your personal information to predict whether you might be a terrorist? A new book reveals the comprehensive scope of government surveillance and finds that the use of sophisticated methods to search for terrorists is not identifying the right suspects. In Illusions of Security, Global Surveillance and Democracy in the Post-9/11 World, human rights lawyer Maureen Webb argues the new global security system is threatening both American and global security while undermining democracy worldwide. Maureen Webb joins us now in the Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Why did you focus on this as a human rights lawyer?
Well, I think it's one of the less examined aspects of the war on terror. And I'm co-chair for a Canadian coalition of civil society groups called the International Civil Liberties Monitoring Group. And in 2004, we brought some of the major NGOs working on these issues from around the world, ACLU in the United States, State Watch in Europe, Focus on the Global South in Asia. And we wanted to look for common patterns that were happening in our countries and see if there was any way that we could collaborate. And what we identified was that there were all of these surveillance initiatives that were being introduced, many of them through international forums like the G8, and that all of our governments seem to be working towards this common goal, but that these initiatives tended to be reported very disparately in the media, and nobody had really connected the dots. And we thought it was important because it's really one of the more insidious aspects of the war on terror. It will have long-term effects on our democratic societies and democratic movements around the world.
You begin your book with Meher Arar, with Monia's story, actually,
yes,
with his wife. How did you meet them? You're a Canadian human rights lawyer, and how does that tie in with this global surveillance infrastructure?
Well, I actually heard about their story on the radio, as a lot of other Canadians did, often when I was driving my kids to daycare in the mornings. And they became very involved in the story as well. They asked some very pertinent questions. They asked, you know, who has taken these children's papa?
Why? You mean your kids were asking this?
Yes. Who took him? Why did they take him? Why can't they get him back? And at the time, I was working on border issues on the Canadian-U.S. border in my job. And so, you know, I understood that this was a sort of a shocking new development, the disappearance of a Canadian citizen. But it was really my kids that engaged me in this story. And I heard Monia talk about her fear that her children would grow up fatherless. And this was what was driving her in her very dignified, very articulate this quest to
Can
get her husband home.
Can you briefly explain what happened? Meher Arar, the victim of, quote, extraordinary rendition taken by U.S. authorities from Kennedy Airport and sent off when he was headed home from a family vacation to Canada, instead sent off to Syria, where he was tortured, held for almost a year, then sent home. But how did they, in Canada, first start to look at him?
Well, after 9/11, the U.S. and Canada began cooperating very closely on national security, and joint teams were set up between agencies like the Mounties in Canada and the FBI, and we think the CIA in America. These later became formalized as integrated national security teams. But they were working very closely, and there were really no sovereign checks and balances on the way that information was shared. And the Mounties, in testimony before the Arar inquiry, they said that they had been given a mandate of prevention and that they were to take a zero-tolerance approach to risk. And this led them to identify what they said was a potential Al-Qaeda cell operating in Ottawa and Toronto. And Meher Arar happened to be it's a small Muslim community in Ottawa. He went for lunch with a fellow that was the target of the investigation.
In 99?
Yes. No, it was after 2001. They were looking at Abdullah al-Malki before that, but they turned it into a big international terrorism investigation after 2001. And he went for lunch with the guy, stood outside in the rain talking about where he could buy a good printer for his computer. And he was marked as a person of interest. They had no evidence that he was linked at all to terrorism. It turned out that they had no evidence, hard evidence, that Abdul al-Malki was linked to terrorism either. But from there, they started sharing information with the FBI and the CIA, with no controls over how that information would be used. And in the end, it turned out that when Arar was identified on a passenger manifest list coming from Tunisia to JFK Airport, the Americans grabbed him and they rendered him to Syria.
And now the Canadian government has awarded him $10 million and demanded that the U.S. take him off a terrorist no-fly list, but the U.S. has refused to comply.
Yes, and in fact, the ambassador has told the Canadian government that they have no business to tell the United States who should be on their terrorist list. Mm.
Well, I want to ask you about all sorts of issues, like Echelon, the global surveillance system, biometrics, how they're being used. We have to take a break. We'll be back with Maureen Webb, human rights attorney and author of Illusions of Security. Stay with us. Somebody is watching me by Rockwell. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, Maureen Webb, human rights attorney and author, is our guest. Her book, Illusions of Security, Global Surveillance and Democracy in the Post-9/11 World. Global Surveillance of Electronic Communications Records and Financial Transactions is the name of one of your chapters. And you start with this George Orwell quote. And he says it was even conceivable that they watched everybody all the time. But at any rate, they could plug in your wire whenever they wanted to. You had to live, did live, from the habit that became instinct and the assumption that every sound you made was overheard. That's from the book 1984. Explain how it is working now.
Well, you know, today in modern societies, each of us is pretty much have our wires plugged in all the time. There's very little you can do without it being recorded some way in an electronic transaction. So after 9/11, governments, the U.S. pushing them, started to look at the communications of people, the financial transactions of people. The NSA program in the United States is a prime example of this. It was a secret program authorized by the president.
This is the National Security Agency wiretapping.
That's right, the domestic wiretapping. It's really a large data mining program which vacuums up almost all of the emails and telephone calls that are made in the United States and sifts through them for specified criteria that state agents believe show terrorist activity.
How does
occurring.
It do it?
Well, you know, this is very sophisticated technology. The NSA and its counterparts in the UK, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia have been searching the cyberspace since 1948. They began looking at telephone calls, and as technology advanced, they kept up with it. But their gazes have always been directed outside their own countries. They've never been allowed to spy inside their own borders. And since it's a secret program, very little is known about it, except that it's a data mining program where they sift through traffic patterns and looking for keywords and traffic patterns. And in the normal exercise of their mandates, they're looking for economic and technical and security intelligence from other countries.
What is the echelon system?
Well, that's the echelon system that was set up after World War II, and it's this cooperation of the Anglo-American countries. But as I said, it always looked outwards. It never looked inwards. And so this was, you know, this was unheard of. And in Canada, we seem to have a similar program that's been authorized by our Anti-Terrorism Act. So it seems that other countries also are turning their very powerful foreign security establishments on the loose.
Can you talk about the global registration system?
Yes. In the book, I describe the main characteristics of this new kind of surveillance. And I think the aim of this new surveillance regime is first to register populations with biometric identity documents. And the idea is that when you have a biometric identifier for everybody, you have a kind of gold standard for making sure you've got the person that you want. And then you can start to, with greater confidence, link information to that biometric identifier. Biometrics is the use of biological characteristics that people have, like fingerprints, iris scans, the dimensions of our faces, which the technology records and then stores either in a database or in a microchip, which can be inserted into identity documents.
And how does it work, for example, a retina scan? And are we going to see these be increasingly mandatory?
They are increasingly mandatory. After 9/11, they began to biometrically register the more marginal populations. So, for example, under the National Security Entry/Exit Registration System, the United States registered all males between the ages of 16 and 45 coming from Muslim countries who were visiting or traveling through the country. And 80,000 men were biometrically registered in this way. Then biometric registration was expanded to all visitors to the U.S., then to all people carrying passports, and then recently a national a de facto national identity card has been introduced in the United States, which is a country, a common law country, which has always resisted the imposition of a national identity card. And now you have a biometric national identity card.
We're talking to Maureen Webb. Interesting last name for this kind of investigation. You talk about UK e-borders initiative, German trawling, flawed facts, dirty information, and guilt by Google. Mm-hmm. Start with the last.
Guilt by Google. That's not copyrighted. these data mining programs, what you have to understand is that they're not sifting through masses of information to find known terrorists or people who are suspected of terrorism on reasonable grounds. What they're doing is they're sifting through all this information they're collecting about us all to predict who might be a terrorist. This is predictive technology. And it's interesting. It comes from the private sector. I was in Chicago recently speaking, and the person who chaired the event was a CEO of a business intelligence company. And he told the audience just how far businesses have gone down this road of collecting every piece of information they can get about their customers and then data mining it and handling it through different technologies. And he spoke about an article that was published in the Harvard Business Review recently, which basically says that, you know, you're nowhere as a business unless you're doing this stuff. And this has been imported by the government into the war on terror. It's predictive analysis.
What's the problem with this?
Well, it's very frightening because, of course, when you're looking at prediction, at preemption, you're not really concerned with accuracy. So that all of the normal protections that we have about our virtual identities, about our personal information, are thrown out of the window. If you're flagged by a data mining program, you'll never know what information has been used against you. You'll never be able to correct or contextualize it. You won't even know the criteria by which you're being judged because they are also secret. So, for example, there's a program that was just revealed about a month ago called the Automated Targeting System Program. And nobody knew that it was operating. In fact, two other programs that were similar to it had been killed by Congress. And this program collects information about people crossing the border, all modes of transportation. It stores it for 40 years, and it assigns risk scores to individuals. And a risk score is a statistical rating of how closely your personal information matches the criteria, the secret criteria that are supposed to protect terrorist activity. And there's no way you can change your risk score, apparently. You can appeal and say, well, I'm not the Jane Doe that you're thinking of, and they can, you know, if they believe you, they can note it down. But apparently, because you can never change the information, you can never change your risk score.
I'm looking at your section on shutting down independent media, where you write, the current risk assessment climate has led to international cooperation in shutting down independent media outlets. In October 2004, two computer servers were seized by the FBI from the England office of the Texas-based internet company Rackspace. The servers were hosting the websites of independent media centers. The seizure was reportedly made under a UK-US mutual assistance treaty of 1996, but on the request of Swiss and Italian police.
Yes, yes. And that's just one illustration of how closely security agencies are cooperating around the world today. For instance, the United States has signed an agreement whereby it has access to all of Europol's information about EU citizens. So some very sensitive information about EU citizens.
Europol?
Europol, the European police.
Interpol?
Interpol is bigger. Europol is for Europe. And so dozens of American agencies now have direct access to this information, which was previously, you know, kept in European hands with European checks and balances. The INSET, the Integrated National Security Enforcement Teams that I spoke about in the context of the Arar affair, you know, under ordinary mutual assistance agreements, formal requests have to be made between the countries to obtain information. And there's all kinds of checks and balances that go with that. They make sure that the information is reliable before they pass it on. They make sure that they know what the other country is going to do with the information. But with these integrated teams, the information just flows informally between the agencies that are working together.
You also talk about it being open season on individuals and groups challenging repressive regimes. How so?
Well, you know, this whole new paradigm of terrorism is being embraced by countries around the world and used in repressive regimes to rebrand opponents as terrorists. And these people are often put on international lists. They're sort of new brutal tactics can be used against them because it's become an accepted paradigm, this idea of terrorism. But it really, you know, I'm not saying that there's not a thing popularly known as terrorism, but it's being used politically to really paint as black and white complex historical and civil conflicts.
You write about how in Tunisia, the lawyers of people charged with terrorism are being charged with terrorism themselves.
Yes.
Now, how do people protect themselves as we travel, either abroad or just at home, as you go on the internet, as you buy things at stores with credit cards? And how does credit cards fit into this?
Well, credit cards, the records are handled by companies, and the companies are subject to the USA Patriot Act. And the USA Patriot Act allows the FBI to issue administrative subpoenas known as national security letters without any just judicial oversight.
Can companies resist?
Well, they can, I suppose, but they're gagged from telling anybody about the very existence of the order against them. And most companies aren't resisting. In fact, many companies are just handing over the information when they're asked. I think, about 175 universities in the United States handed over information about their students without any request for a subpoena. As you mentioned, scuba diving associations handed over discs with information on 2 million members. And we know that companies, airlines were handing over information to the Transportation Security Administration.
And, of course, telephone companies.
And telephone companies. 4 out of 5 of the major telephone companies in the U.S. handed over their records to the NSA for this domestic spy program. And they did it for money.
What do you mean for money?
Well, it was a contract under which they were paid to hand over this material.
We have 30 seconds. What do you think is the most important thing to leave listeners and viewers with?
I want listeners to understand that they have some control over what happens in the future. Our democratic societies are at risk of being turned into surveillance societies over time. And we've got to inform ourselves about what's happening and tell our democratic representatives that we don't want them to pass these laws and these measures.
Maureen Webb, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Maureen Webb is the author of Illusions of Security, Global Surveillance and Democracy in the Post-9/11 World. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Maté, Jen Utes, Anuradha Bhagwati, Megan Whitney, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Noguera are our engineers. Also, special thanks to Angela Alston, Uri Galad, Hugh Grant, Tyshawn Black, John Randolph, Peter Yoon, Kieran Krugmeadows, Jillian O'Connor, Samantha Chamblee will be at Columbia Journalism School Wednesday. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.